right. Well, here we are. To dream again. To dare again. To feel enjoyment and happiness again. Or for the first time. To realize this is living. Be inspired. To see your life as an exciting journey of discovery. With your host of the Inspire Possibility Show, Mark Sussman.
Hi, everybody. This is Mark Sussnell. Thanks for tuning in to the Inspire Possibility Show. Each week, I invite some amazing people to join us and hopefully enlighten us and teach us and inspire us and to inspire us to think in a different way, a way that is more optimistic and more or less just giving you a support system so you can be bold and say what you really hope for and wish for. And, you know, one of the things that I think we all need to do more of is to laugh. And I've known this person for, I can't say know him, but I've known of him. His name is Swami Vivekananda. That's what I heard the first time. And I'm thinking, what's with this guy, this name, Swami Vivekananda? I was on the island of Kauai. And he was there performing, and in Kauai there's not a lot to do in the evenings. So I said, okay, we'll go hear him. And that's the first time I actually heard him. A few times in Marin County I've heard him. Heard him recently. And I've gotten to know Steve Behrman, who goes, is a.k.a. as Swami Vivekananda, and invited him to be on our show. And what's interesting about him is you're all familiar with Marianne Williamson. And she's called him the Mark Twain of our generation. That's quite a bold statement. And I want to know more about that, what she means by that. And so, Steve, welcome to the Inspire Possibility Show.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for inspiring possibilities. You know, that quote by Marianne Williamson, she gave me that quote about 6 or 7 years ago. And 2 years ago, I was doing a performance in Kansas City with another performer, trying to remember his name. Oh, my God. Anyway, and Larry Dorsey called this guy the Mark Twain of our generation. I said, you know, and we talked about it. How do we take advantage of it? So I put out a publicity piece saying we're two Twains going down the same twack with one locomotive. Our locomotive is to make so. That's what we did. And so... Yeah, I think what she meant is that, in a way, it's what I do through the form of the Swami. It's spiritual, but it's also social commentary. It's also perspective, and as we'll discover as we unwrap this conversation a bit, there's something of that humor that allows us to breach subjects in a way that makes them less offensive and less defensive.
Right.
And allows us to have our hearts opened and receive information in a new way and perhaps get a different perspective about things. As an example, I'm sure you're wondering, many people are wondering, why do jokes always happen in threes? A minister, a priest, and a rabbi. So, a minister,
right,
a priest,
that's
a, and a rabbi.
Yeah, I often, yeah, tell me.
Yeah, a minister, a priest, and a rabbi, they're discussing their legacy. How do they want to be remembered? What do they want the eulogist to be saying over them when they're lying there in their casket? And the minister says, well, I want them to say he was a family man and a pillar of his community. The priest says, I want them to say he was a holy man and a leader of his flock. The rabbi says, I want him to say, look, I think he's breathing. So what happens? So what happens is we live in a dualistic world. It's this or that, and humor happily offers us a third way, so that we can look beyond these two polarities to something that's outside the box, and perhaps a creative solution that hasn't been thought of before.
Well, you know, I always think that people teach what they want to learn. And I always ask this question if I'm interviewing whoever it is, especially authors. Somebody might write a book on happiness, and I'm always curious, well, what was going on in your life that you wanted to really investigate what happiness is? And for you, you're such a humorist. So were you always like this, or did you come from a place where you said, you know what, I got to be happier, life's kind of dull? So what prompted you to devote your life to humor?
Well, first of all, you got it right the first time. I was always this way. I was the kid who would be disruptive in class, and I was a class comedian, and you know that you're that archetype. The first time you're in the lunchroom and you make another kid laugh so hard that milk comes out of their nose.
That's a good point.
However, so for me, it wasn't necessarily, having humor transform my life. I've always had humor. However, it's been the way that I've used humor. And the life-changing incident that happened for me was when, the first one was when a funny thing happened. You know, a lot of times, a funny thing happened. And
exactly.
What the funny thing was that I never, even though I always loved humor, I was always good at it, I used it in everything I did when I was a teacher, when I was a college professor, everything I did had humor in it. And the people that remember me from when I was in high school and college and early adulthood, they all remember the humor. That's the one thing they remember. I never imagined I would be doing it for a living. And I found myself at one point teaching at Wayne State University in Detroit. It was a really wonderful job. I loved what I was doing. I was teaching auto workers. I was teaching adult auto workers, labor history and ethnic studies. It was great, but then a funny thing happened, but I wasn't laughing. And the funny thing that happened was I got laid off from this job. And
mm-hmm.
They had to place their tenured people. I was just a temporary. And the only job I could get, because I had lived on a farm and knew how to operate farm equipment, was as a tree trimmer for the city of Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking down trees that had Dutch elm disease. Now, this is a true story. I'm not making this up. My Jewish mother was concerned that I would catch Dutch elm disease, right?
Uh-huh.
So I said, you know, Mom, people don't get Dutch elm disease. Dogs get it. She goes, dogs get it. What happens to dogs? I said, well, they lose their bark. So I'm with this job, and I'm not really seeing my future. With my mom, you had to do that. I'm not really seeing my future in this. And at the time, I had already written a book on education about my experiences teaching at an alternative high school, and I was doing a follow-up book. I had done interviews with my former students, and you know how sometimes you're working on a project and it ain't working. It's not going anywhere. My agent couldn't sell it. My previous publisher didn't want it, but I'm just moving ahead thinking that's my way out. And I hear this voice in my head, and it says, let that go. It's the past. You need to focus on the future. And, of course, I didn't know what the future was, but I did let it go, and it felt good. And a few weeks later, at work, they put a new guy with me who was a brilliant psychologist disguised as a truck driver. And he got the idea. He says, you know, you're a writer. Why don't we start a humorous newspaper for the guys at the shop? And so that's exactly what we did. And the thing that transformed my life and turned me in the direction that I've been in for the last 30-plus years is we started a little underground newspaper that's a lot like what you would see Andy Borowitz now or The Onion or something like that. And it was we turned all of our coworkers at this little shop into larger-than-life heroes. We had an ongoing interactive situation comedy. And I won't go into details about what we did, but I'll keep it really short. what I discovered was the power that humor had at that point, and I recognized my gift for doing it. And so a few years later, I ended up launching
Steve, Steve, what it sounds like, the turning point was getting laid off.
It was.
Right?
It was. It was the dark night. You know, I mean, here I am. My favorite job. I love this job. And I loved it, and I was good at it. And the workers would bring their wives because they were so entertained. All of a sudden, that rug gets pulled out from under me, and it's the middle of winter in Michigan. If you've ever been through that, and I'm moonlighting, driving a snowplow at night, right?
You know. Wow.
So, and I'm going, what's wrong with this picture? I've had a book published by Simon & Schuster. I've been a professor at Wayne State University. Here I am putting on a jumpsuit and a hard hat every day. And, it didn't compute. And all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, out of left field, out of amazing grace, this opportunity, and I totally enjoyed it. You know, my friend Larry, my co-author on this, my downstairs neighbor would sometimes come running up because she would hear us screaming and pounding the floor because we were laughing so hard at what we were going to put in the paper. That's how
wow.
much fun we had.
So that was amazing how that just happened, and then it's 30 years later.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. In fact, I have to tell you, this year will be the 40th anniversary of our Creating States Wire Service. And if 40 years ago, right about now, I was going through this dark night. It was January in Michigan. I'm driving a snowplow, you know, and I'm trying to get out of that situation by writing a serious book. And the guidance that I got, and I don't usually have voices speaking in my head, the guidance that I got was stop, stop. And it was stop, look, and listen. And the opportunity came not more than 2 weeks later.
Right. I mean, it just shows you how you never know when that opportunity is. I mean, this, you know, as you know, you're familiar with my work, and I always say life's a mystery. And you never know. I mean, the next day, something amazing can walk into your life.
I don't know if you pointed this out in your book. I think you might have. But why is it that synchronicities happen when you're traveling? You know, I think it's because you're already up for adventure. You're not doing your planned life. Something, you know, it's
you're
kind
more,
of
yeah, and you're more open, too. You're more open.
Exactly, exactly. So
yeah.
I think that, you know, and of course, sometimes when we're in a crisis, and our normal resources are not available to us, we have to look elsewhere, and all
we're
of
we're more vulnerable.
Exactly, that's a good way
yeah.
to describe it.
Yeah, we're more vulnerable and more open, and kind of like it's almost like we don't have a choice. I mean, it's like we all the things that we relied on. Our formula for life is no longer working. We have to say, okay, no longer working, and so it's painful, but we have to say, okay, what's out there? And but when we're going through it, we don't realize that. We don't think, well, this is really an opportunity. But I think that's the lesson here, is at the darkest moment, there's a light, and we just have to be open to see it and to let it guide us.
Yeah, and, you know, this was a relatively easy one for me because it took me totally by surprise, and I totally loved writing. I realized, the first time we put our paper out, I had a girlfriend who delivered it, left it there at 11:30. The guys came in for lunch at noon, and I hear these papers, and I'm in the men's room, and I'm listening from afar, and I hear all of these screams of delight, because these guys have picked up the paper, they're reading about themselves. I was an amateur cartoonist, I did some cartoons for it, and the workplace was never the same. during the 2-year period that I did that paper, and my friend Larry and I did that paper.
So then you did the paper, you're in Michigan, and how did you get to California and then Hawaii? I mean, that's because I know you've been to Kauai a few times, been to Maui. So how did that evolve?
Well, first of all, sometimes things have to do with declarations. And what I did, that was in 1978, 1980, January of 80, a friend and I, different friends, started a paper in Ann Arbor called Pathways. And it was one of the first local holistic publications. And we needed some comedy because we realized that people took their personal growth and their spirituality and their health very seriously. So
definitely.
This name flew in my head, Swami Beyond Ananda. So Swami's column began to appear, and it became the most popular thing in the paper. And during that time, I wrote the paper. I worked as a freelance writer. I wrote books for people. I wrote a book under my own name with a psychologist called Friends and Lovers, How to Meet the People You Want to Meet. And lo and behold, I met my wife, Trudy. And that was also very, very because
and that came out of the paper you were doing, right? Is how you met Trudy.
Well, it came out of the of writing a book, Friends and Lovers: How to Meet the People You Want to Meet, which actually, in doing this Pathways magazine, I met a lot of people, and I found people who wanted me to write books with them and all that. I took a seminar, and it was a EST-related, Werner Erhard-related seminar at the end of 1984. And the challenge in that seminar was, what is it that you really want to do, and how long do you want to wait before you do it? And at that point, I realized that my calling, without even knowing how I was going to do it, my calling was, I want to do comedy as a full-time career. And then very shortly after that, I met Trudy, and the thought had never occurred to me to go traveling and performing. I thought I was a writer of comedy.
Right.
And that's what we've been doing for the past 31 years.
What a great story.
And so that took us from Michigan to living in a van, a beautiful travel trailer and van for 4 years, moving to the Texas Hill Country for 8 years, where we lived in what Trudy called a National Geographic special, because we were out in the middle of the country in a beautiful place in a beautiful home on top of a hill on a lake, and was great in the middle of the country, able to travel. And then in 1999, we realized that we had a lot of really, really excellent connections in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and we moved to Santa Rosa, where we've been ever since.
Wow. Yeah, amazing. Amazing. So what is your advice to other people right now from your life path to this transition to come out to Santa Rosa? There's a message there. What would it be?
Well, of course, whenever anybody asks a Swami for advice, he says, my advice is don't listen to me. But since I'm not being the Swami now, I'm being Steve. You know, I think that it really makes sense. We often, and I know that I did for the first, 30 years of my life, take for granted the gifts that we're given. Comedy, I never, ever, ever imagined that I would be a professional. Now, maybe it was partly because I didn't, as a kid, I don't think I was in a really, I live in a housing project, and, I never really thought of myself as somebody that could, make it. And yet, at the age of 17 or 18, Woody Allen, for example, was writing for Ed Sullivan for his column. And at the
he
age
was?
Of 19,
wow.
Yeah, at the age of 19, Woody Allen was writing for Sid Caesar, your show of shows, along with Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner, etc. So he had chutzpah, so to speak, to go do that.
Right.
When I was 18 years old, I took the subway from Brooklyn, where I lived, to Lafayette Street in Manhattan, and there I got a glimpse of my heroes in action at Mad Magazine. Now, at that age, at 13 and 14, I was writing pretty sophisticated song parodies and so on, and if I had pursued it, I'm sure that I would have had at least a little gig as a teenager writing comedy. But it never occurred to me because of, you know, my nature being a bit shy and alienated and so on. And the universe had to create this big thing for me, you know, to show me what my gift was. So
Steve, I got another question for you. You know, when you mentioned Woody Allen, have you met Woody Allen?
Well, indirectly. As a freshman at Brooklyn College, I was an usher at the first, like on his first comedy tour, Woody Allen and the Brothers Four, and that's where he did some of the famous routines like, you know, this is the watch my grandfather sold me on his deathbed, and so on. So I've never met Woody Allen. I've always admired his work, and so on. I mean, now, of course, he is about to be expunged from the record books, which is a sad thing. I think it's perfectly fine to address and the perpetrations that he's done. That shouldn't be a reflection on his artistry. I think that there's, and same with Bill Cosby and all of those other people who were flawed human beings. I mean, you wouldn't, you know, Ty Cobb once tried to kill a man, took a gun to him, tried to kill him. You wouldn't take Ty Cobb out of the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's the
right
past. So that's always
the challenge, to separate. Right, to separate the person's accomplishments from whatever field it is, from his character. That's always, sometimes person's character gets in the way of their acknowledging him as who he is as an artist, or, you know, in the baseball world, they're like Pete Rose is not inducted in the Hall of Fame, maybe one of the greatest players ever, because of the gambling and Barry Bonds with the steroids. And, you always get confused between the message and the messenger. So let me ask you a question. Who are some of the – I've been asking you a lot of questions, right? which people ask the Swami, but who are some other comedians that – you know, you'd like to just talk to them. I remember I read a book that I actually, when I was a lawyer, I went to a storytelling workshop, how lawyers can introduce storytelling into their law practice. And then when I was working on my first book, Dancing on the River, I was looking at other inspirational books, and I saw the storyteller wrote a book called The Beggar King and the Secret of Happiness. His name was Joel Ben-Izzy. It moved me so much that I Googled him, and I said, you know, I want to thank you for writing that book. It so inspired me to want to be a better writer. And I'm just wondering if there's somebody in your life that you have that same inspiration from, that you'd like to just email them or call them and say, hey, I just want to thank you for inspiring me to be better at what I do as a humorist, as a comedian, as a person. Is there anybody like that?
Yeah, you know, there were three influences I had as a kid. Two nobody knows about, and one maybe somebody knows about. The two nobody knows about, first is my dad. My dad was a naturally individual. I see a picture of him when he was in the Army during World War II. He's in front of a microphone. His hat is on sideways. I see people in the audience laughing. I have no idea what he was doing, but it was funny. He was great at dialects. He worked at a hotel in Manhattan, which was a residential hotel where famous people lived. he would do imitations. The second was my dentist, Dr. Max Mitchell. Bless his heart. How many people go to hang out with a dentist? I did, because he had such an extraordinary sense of humor. He and I would create pranks together. And I watched him. I watched how he used humor to communicate. I watched how he made his patients feel at ease. I watched how he appropriately played with the ladies using humor. And I just saw he passed several years ago. He was like 95, and I really, really wish I had kept up and known him as an adult. The third character was a writer named H. Allen Smith. And H. Allen Smith was a journalist who wrote in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And the first book I ever came across by him was called Lost in the Horse Latitudes, and was in my grandparents' library. And I read this, I must have read this book 100 times. And his writing style so influenced me. It influenced how I learned to use paradox, how I learned to use nuance. And incidentally, reading Woody Allen's book, what was it called? I forget what it's called. Reading one of his books really influenced my writing as well. Then, of course, there were the comedians on TV. And, of course, my favorite, I'd watch everybody. I'd watch Sid Caesar, et cetera. My favorite was Steve Allen, particularly when I was getting to be a teenager, because I could sense the sophistication in his humor. And I was so blessed to be able to meet Steve Allen after I wrote the Swami book, When You See a Sacred Cow, Milk It for All It's Worth, and make him laugh. I was happy that I was able to make him laugh. He was a great hero of mine. He was tremendously prolific. And then, of course, there are the people who are just so naturally gifted, like Robin Williams and George Carlin.
Jonathan Winters.
Well, that's right. Jonathan Winters was Robin Williams before Robin Williams, and unfortunately, he was 20 or 25 years ahead of his time and never got the
I mean, I've recently, I was listening to, it's interesting when you start going to YouTube, there's a song I've been wanting to learn, and I would go on YouTube and I'd listen to it, and then all of a sudden on the side, you would see other clips, and for some reason, it turned to comedy. So I've been seeing clips of Jonathan Winters on Johnny Carson, pretty amazing guy, and I can see so much the similarity that and with Robin Williams, how Robin Williams adopted.
Robin Williams honored Jonathan Winters by having him be on the show the last season of Mork and Mindy, and in fact, one of the reasons why it was the last season was because Jonathan Winters was on there. And Robin Williams could always kind of bring it back around. You know, his wild and crazy mind, whether it was on cocaine or not, was always able to bring it back around. And a lot of what they did in that last season on Mork and Mindy had to do with improv. Well, Jonathan, he'd go off on a tangent somewhere, and there was no reeling him in. And, it seems to be entertaining, in his later years, I never met him. I wish I had. But friends I know knew him in Santa Barbara. And he'd just be on the street in Santa Barbara, engaging with people like you and I are talking right now. And he would do his shit and so on. And clearly, it was so much of a gift in his way of seeing and thinking, and the public didn't have the sophistication to encompass that in the 50s.
So, Steve, we only have a minute or so left, and I want to let listeners know how they can contact you. I know you're available for live performances. I'm sure. So if you could tell us how people can get hold of you, how they can get your books, and what your books are.
Okay, well, first of all, they can find me at wakeuplaughing.com. They can send me an email at info@wakeuplaughing.com. Swami's latest CD is called Live in the Here and Now. And most recent book is called Swami for President, A Seven-Step Plan to Heal the Body Politic and Cure Electile Dysfunction. On the serious side, I wrote a book with the cellular biologist Bruce Lipton called Spontaneous Evolution, and you can find that there as well. Also, I have a new radio show called Wiki Politiki, WikiPolitiki, Wiki Politiki. It's on OM Times Radio, as in OM, O-M. You can find it that way. And you can also find it and download it as a podcast on iTunes. So just go to iTunes, search for Wiki, W-I-K-I, Politiki, P-O-L-I-T-I-K-I, and there you'll find the show that's really designed to have co-creative conversations to bring left and right, front and center, the face, the music, and dance together.
All right, Steve. So thanks so much for being my guest on the Inspire Possibility Show. And to listeners out there, as you know, every week we have some amazing people that will inspire us, make us laugh, make us think, make us see new possibilities. And in the meantime, until next week, journey on.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Inspire Possibility Show with Mark Susnow. To learn more about Mark Susnow, go to inspirepossibility.com and click on the contact button. Schedule a complimentary visit with Mark or email him at mark@inspirepossibility.com. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine.